All right, let's jump right in. Today, we're diving deep into a topic that's, well, it's generating a lot of buzz, that's for sure. Climate change,
Yeah.
and specifically some recent political appointments that are raising eyebrows, to say the least. You're talking about Chris Wright, nominated for Energy Secretary, and Lee Zeldin for EPA Administrator.
Two very, very significant nominations.
Absolutely. And, these nominations are happening against a backdrop of, well, those devastating wildfires in Los Angeles.
Yeah, a real tragedy.
Absolutely.
Oh.
Over 40,000 acres burned, 25 lives lost, and the fight to contain them is still ongoing. It really brings the issue of climate change front and center, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. And it really underscores the urgency of the situation, the need for, decisive action.
Couldn't agree more. Before we get too far into it, though, a quick shout out to all the weather geeks out there.
Okay.
If you're looking for some seriously cool meteorological content, check out meteorologist Rob Jones. Instagram at meteorologist, TikTok at TV meteorologist, and on YouTube, follow at Rob Jones Hurricane.
Wow, that's a lot of platforms.
He's everywhere. Hurricanes, forecasting, climate, you name it, he covers it. Oh, and his podcast, Meteorology Matters, is definitely worth a listen. He's even got videos from hurricane chasing and samples of his own, on-air work in television.
Sounds impressive.
He's the real deal. Okay, now back to our deep dive. So these nominations, they're happening at such a crucial time, with climate change becoming more and more, well, impossible to ignore.
Right.
What's your take on the significance of these nominations, especially given, like we said, the current situation?
Well, I think they offer a kind of a window into how the new Trump administration might approach climate change policy.
Interesting.
We're seeing a shift, I think, from outright denial to a more nuanced stance.
Okay.
Both nominees, they acknowledge that climate change is happening, but they have differing views on how serious it is and what the right response should be.
That's fascinating. So let's unpack that a bit. Let's start with Chris Wright, the Energy Secretary nominee. He's made some pretty provocative statements about the connection between climate change and those wildfires we were just talking about. What's the gist of his argument?
Well, he's downplayed the link, even gone as far as calling it hype.
Hype. That's a strong word.
It is. And he points to declining global acreage burned by wildfires as evidence for his position.
Okay, so he's basically saying that climate change isn't the main driver.
Right. He's suggesting that other factors are more significant.
Interesting. But hype. I mean, that's pretty dismissive, especially considering the overwhelming consensus in the scientific community that climate change is, well, it's fueling these wildfires.
Yes, and particularly in places like the Western US and Australia.
Exactly. So why use that kind of language, do you think?
Well, it seems like he's trying to frame the issue in a way that downplays the urgency, the need for drastic changes.
So not outright denial, but maybe a way to, shift the narrative a bit.
Exactly.
Okay. What about his argument about the declining global acreage? How does that square with the scientific evidence?
Well, scientists argue that just looking at the total acreage burned, it's misleading.
Okay.
It misses the bigger picture. While some areas might be experiencing fewer wildfires, other regions are seeing unprecedented fire activity, and that activity is directly linked to climate change.
It's like saying crime is down overall, but ignoring a spike in specific neighborhoods. You can't just look at the big picture, right? You have to understand the regional variations and the underlying causes.
That's a great analogy. And in the Western US, for instance, we're seeing hotter, drier conditions and this phenomenon called weather whiplash, periods of heavy rain followed by intense dryness. It's creating perfect conditions for these massive fires to ignite and spread.
Wow, weather whiplash. That sounds intense.
It is. And it's making these fires much more difficult to control.
So is that all Wright has to support his position, or is there more?
Well, he's also argued that cold temperatures are more deadly than heat.
Interesting tactic. Trying to downplay the risks of a warming planet.
It seems that way. But scientists, they point out that attributing lower cold-related deaths solely to climate change, it ignores other factors like better housing, healthcare, things like that.
Right, so improvements in living conditions and technology might also be playing a role. It's more complex than just saying, oh, it's warmer, so fewer people are dying from the cold.
Exactly. And you can't ignore the projections, which show that climate change could lead to a significant increase in heat-related deaths in the future.
So it seems like he's cherry-picking data points to support his view without really addressing the broader context.
That's fair assessment.
Okay, so we have this clear clash of opinions, right? What are the potential consequences of having an energy secretary who holds these views? I mean, what does that mean for policy?
It raises serious questions about how the Department of Energy will approach climate change mitigation and energy policy in general.
Right.
Will the focus be on promoting fossil fuels or investing in renewable energy?
Big question.
And how will his stance on climate change affect funding for things like wildfire prevention and research into the link between climate change and these devastating events?
It seems like his position could have a ripple effect across the entire energy sector. Now, let's shift gears a bit and talk about Lee Zeldin, Trump's pick for EPA administrator. What's notable about his nomination, and what are some of the potential controversies surrounding him?
Well, his nomination is interesting because, unlike some figures in the previous Trump administration, he acknowledges that climate change is real and that it poses a threat.
Okay, so he's not a climate denier. That's something, at least.
Right. But he's also stated that he believes the EPA is authorized, not required, to regulate carbon dioxide emissions.
Wait, so he acknowledges the problem, but maybe doesn't feel obligated to act on it? That's a bit of a head-scratcher.
It is, and it's raising concerns about how committed he'll be to tackling CO2 emissions, which are, of course, a major driver of climate change.
Can you unpack that distinction a little bit? Authorized versus required. And what does that actually mean in practical terms?
Sure. He's referring to a 2007 Supreme Court decision that gave the EPA the authority to regulate greenhouse gases like CO2. But he seems to be interpreting that ruling as, well, not necessarily mandating such regulation.
So he has the power, but might choose not to use it.
Potentially.
That's a bit concerning. Is there anything in his track record that gives us any clues about how he might approach environmental issues?
Well, his voting record has been under scrutiny, and he has a pretty low score from the League of Conservation Voters.
Ah, so not exactly a champion of environmental protection, then.
Not based on that score, no.
But wait, you said earlier that he does acknowledge climate change as a threat. How does he reconcile that with his, well, his seemingly hesitant stance on regulation?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? It's possible he believes other approaches are more effective than government regulation, things like technological innovation or market-based solutions.
So maybe he's more of a let the free market handle it kind of guy.
Possibly. Or maybe he sees a stronger need to balance environmental protection with economic growth.
Ah, yes, that age-old tension. Jobs versus the environment. It'll be fascinating to see how he navigates that if he is confirmed as EPA administrator.
Definitely. Yeah, it's a tricky balance, for sure. And it raises some really, you know, fundamental questions about, well, about the role of government, right?
Right.
And how we balance economic growth with environmental protection. And even, I think, about how we have these debates about science itself.
Absolutely. It's not just about wildfires or emissions. It's about how we, you know, as a society, how we make these tough decisions, especially when you're dealing with such complex issues like climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one thing that really jumped out at me was how both Wright and Zeldin, they seem to really emphasize this idea of American innovation, right? Like technology as the solution.
Yes, exactly. Wright talks about relentless U.S. innovation and technology solutions. And Zeldin, he seems to believe that, well, that economic growth can actually lead to environmental progress.
Interesting. But it makes you wonder, like, what specific technologies are they talking about? I mean, are we talking about things like carbon capture or maybe advanced nuclear reactors?
Yeah.
Or even like geoengineering?
Yeah, those are all possibilities. And then the question becomes, you know, how do we actually develop and deploy these technologies? Is it primarily through government-funded research? Or does the private sector take the lead?
Right, because it makes you think, like, could this focus on technology, could it actually delay other measures that we need to take? Like, you know, reducing our use of fossil fuels or promoting energy efficiency? Could it be a way to kind of stall while appearing to address the problem?
That's a valid concern. And it really highlights the need for a more, more holistic approach to climate change.
Yeah, like we need to be tackling it from all angles.
Exactly. We need technological innovation for sure, but we also need policy changes, behavioral shifts, and investments in adaptation and resilience.
Right. It's like we need this all of the above strategy.
Yeah.
And it needs to be informed by science, but also it has to consider the economic, social, and political realities. It's a tall order.
It is. But as we've seen, the stakes are, well, incredibly high.
No doubt about it. And that brings us back to this tension between, you know, economic growth and environmental protection. It's often framed as this zero-sum game, like we have to choose one or the other. But is that really true? Like, do we really have to sacrifice economic prosperity to be sustainable? Or can we actually achieve both?
That's the question, isn't it? And it's one that Zeldin, he seems to be grappling with. He talks about protecting the environment without suffocating the economy.
So he's suggesting that there's a way to find that middle ground to kind of have our cake and eat it too.
It seems that way, but how do you actually balance those interests, especially when they seem so, you know, fundamentally opposed?
Yeah, because, I mean, his background is kind of interesting, right? Representing that coastal district on Long Island, an area that's very vulnerable to, you know, sea level rise and other climate impacts. So maybe that shaped his views, right? Yeah,
possibly. He's probably seen firsthand how environmental degradation can really threaten livelihoods, especially in industries that depend on a healthy environment, like, you know, tourism and fishing.
Right. So maybe his focus on economic growth isn't just about, you know, profits for businesses, but also about making sure that communities can thrive, that industries can be sustainable in the long run.
Exactly. And it highlights the fact that a healthy economy, it really depends on a healthy environment.
Yeah.
And vice versa.
It's like they're intertwined, right?
Yeah.
But how do we make that connection clear to people,
yeah,
especially those who might see environmental protection as, you know, an obstacle to economic growth?
Well, I think that's where the role of science and really public discourse becomes so important. We need to make sure our policies are grounded in the best available science. But we also need to be, you know, flexible and adapt as we learn more. And, you know, we need to create spaces where we can have these thoughtful, respectful conversations, even when we disagree.
It's about fostering this culture of curiosity, right?
Yeah.
And critical thinking, where we're constantly questioning our assumptions and, you know, looking at the evidence and trying to understand different perspectives.
Yeah.
But how do we do that in a world that often seems so polarized, so resistant to, you know, nuanced conversations?
It's not easy. But it's absolutely essential. And I think it starts with the commitment to listening to each other, even when we, you know, when we hold different views, trying to find that common ground while still acknowledging, you know, that we might have differences, recognizing that at the end of the day, we're all in this together.
Right. And the best solutions, they're probably going to come from collaboration, from tapping into that collective wisdom. It's a powerful message, and one that I think resonates with people, regardless of their, you know, their politics or their views on climate change. Because at the end of the day, we all want a future where our kids and grandkids can thrive. And we all have a role to play in making that future a reality.
Absolutely. But it's important to acknowledge that we're at a critical juncture. The decisions we make now in the coming years, they're going to have a profound impact on the trajectory of climate change and the future of our planet.
So as we wrap up this part of our deep dive, what are some key questions that our listeners should be thinking about, you know, as they consider these nominations and really the broader issue of climate change?
Well, I think it's worth asking ourselves, you know, what role should the U.S. play in addressing climate change on a global scale?
Right, because we are a global leader.
Exactly. And given our, you know, our historical contribution to greenhouse gas emissions, what responsibility do we have to help mitigate the impacts and to support, you know, developing countries as they transition to cleaner energy sources?
Welcome back to our deep dive.
Yeah.
We've been, you know, really digging into these nominations. Chris Wright for Energy Secretary, Lee Zeldin for EPA Administrator. Mm-hmm. Their views on everything from wildfires to CO2 emissions and that whole struggle between, you know, growing the economy and protecting the environment.
Yeah, some really, really key issues.
Absolutely. But let's step back for a minute, big picture time. What are the big trends that are shaping, you know, the whole climate landscape, both here in the U.S. and globally?
Well, I think one of the most striking trends is just, well, the sheer urgency of the climate crisis. We're seeing the impacts, you know, happening right now all around us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Extreme weather events, sea levels rising, loss of biodiversity. It's alarming. And the science is clear. We need to act, and we need to act decisively to mitigate these impacts and, you know, to avoid those worst case scenarios.
And yet here we are still debating, still disagreeing about what to do, how to move forward. Some folks are pushing for a rapid shift to renewables. Others are banking on, you know, technology or market-based solutions. It's a lot to navigate. How do we even begin to find a path forward with so many different opinions, so many different approaches.
It's definitely a challenge, but I think what's encouraging is that these discussions, they're not just happening in, you know, scientific journals anymore. They're happening everywhere, in our communities, in businesses, in government.
That's true.
We're seeing young people demanding action. Businesses, even investors, are putting pressure on governments to be more ambitious with their climate policies.
It's almost like it's gone from this niche scientific debate to a much broader conversation about our values, our priorities. What kind of future do we want?
Exactly. And I think that shift is reflected in how we talk about climate change now. It's not just an environmental issue anymore. It's a social justice issue. It's an economic issue. It's a national security issue.
It touches everything.
It does. And that reframing, I think it's crucial because it brings more people to the table. Faith-based organizations, labor unions, healthcare professionals, everyone's starting to see how climate change will impact their lives, their communities, their work.
It's like we're finally starting to connect the dots.
Right. And that's key, because to really tackle climate change, we need everyone on board. It can't just be scientists or activists. It has to be a collective effort.
A global effort.
Absolutely. It's a global challenge that demands global cooperation.
So where do we start? Where's that collaboration most critical?
Well, one of the most urgent areas is reducing emissions, right? Greenhouse gas emissions. We need a global framework that sets ambitious targets and supports developing countries as they transition to cleaner energy.
And that framework, it needs to be fair, right? It
right.
can't just benefit those who have historically, you know, contributed the most to the problem.
You're absolutely right. Equity is paramount. And it needs to be flexible, too. You know, the science is always evolving. Technology is changing. We have to be adaptable and willing to adjust as we learn more.
We can't get stuck in our ways.
Exactly. And then there's the whole issue of adaptation and resilience. As the impacts of climate change become more intense, we need to invest in infrastructure, early warning systems, disaster preparedness, helping communities cope with what's coming.
And that investment needs to be targeted, right?
Yeah.
Making sure those who are most vulnerable, those who are often least equipped to deal with these changes, that they get the support they need.
Absolutely. It's about making sure that no one is left behind as we navigate this, well, this unprecedented challenge.
We're all in this together.
We are. But, you know, amid all these challenges, there are also opportunities.
Oh, okay.
The transition to a cleaner, more sustainable economy, it has the potential to create jobs, to drive innovation, to improve public health. It could lead to greater energy independence, less reliance on fossil fuels, a more resilient and equitable society.
So it's not just about avoiding disaster. It's about building a better world.
Exactly. It's about reframing the narrative, seeing climate action not as a burden, but as a chance to create a world that's more just, more sustainable, more prosperous for all. And that's a message that's resonating with more and more people around the world.
It's a message of hope, of possibility, of human ingenuity and resilience. It's a powerful message, and one that we need to keep shouting from the rooftops, especially when we're facing these daunting challenges, these political headwinds.
We have to remember that we have the power to shape our own future. We can create a world where both people and the planet can thrive. But it takes courage, it takes commitment, and a shared vision for a better future.
Couldn't have said it better myself. As we wrap up this deep dive, what's one final thought you want to leave our listeners with?
Engage with this issue. Stay informed. Have those tough conversations and make your voice heard. Whether it's through voting, advocating for policy changes, or just making more sustainable choices in your own life, every action, no matter how small, it counts. The future is in our hands.
Those are words to live by. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into climate change and these pivotal political appointments. We hope you found this conversation insightful and maybe even a little bit inspiring. Remember, knowledge is power. The more we understand these challenges, the better equipped we'll be to find solutions. Keep learning, keep asking questions, and keep diving deep.